The number of people in the unemployment line dropped.
So why then is the jobless rate expected to stay high?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, September 2nd.
The feds are still looking into the so-called flash crash, and they have a new theory as to what happened. Chinese mobile phone users ante up their personal info to the government. And later, how a wonder at nature turned a hiker and YouTube sensation into a photo software pitch man. But first,
word this morning from the Labor Department, the number of people filing for unemployment for the first time fell slightly by 6,000 to 472,000. Analysts say for sustained growth to take hold, that number should be far lower. And that's the thrust of the question this morning, whether the unemployment rate will eventually come down. Just a day away from the August jobs report, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports high unemployment may be here to stay.
Economists talk about the structural rate of unemployment. Think of it as the economy's sweet spot. If you want a job, it doesn't take too long to find one. If you're hiring, you can get the skilled workers you need. This is where we were before the Great Recession. Monthly unemployment was just about 5%, enough churn in the labor market to keep things humming along. Now unemployment's double that. Ken Matheny is with Macroeconomic Advisors.
And it's going to be many years at least before we see unemployment back to kind of typical 5% range.
Could we ever go that low again? Economists at the IMF think not, that structural unemployment may now be more like 6 to 7%. The argument is our economy has become less able to provide jobs where they're needed.
Labor markets aren't functioning as well as we'd like. People seem to be kind of frozen in place, have a difficult time buying and selling houses to support better matching of location with where new jobs might be created.
The housing market should eventually thaw, letting people move around again. But what about other labor market problems, like employers unable to find enough skilled workers for new technology jobs? Couldn't that push unemployment permanently higher? Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research doesn't think so.
There's no real good reason to think that our economy has fundamentally changed with this mismatch of skills and jobs. You know, the reality is the economy does not change that quickly.
Baker says what's holding employment back isn't some structural shift in the economy, but simply a lousy economy where no one's feeling confident enough to hire again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
By the way, interested in where the economy is going? We talked to a psychic to get her take on the future of this recovery. This week, what does she have to say about the big employment report coming out tomorrow? That's at our website, marketplace.org. Some chain store retailers said today, yeah, people were worried about jobs in August, and it was super hot in a lot of places, but consumers also did some buying. Wholesaler Costco reported better than expected numbers thanks to its international operation. Macy's and The Limited also reported solid revenues for August year over year.
Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke is testifying today to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission about the meltdown of 2008. Even while the man has his hands full here in 2010, economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial joins us each Thursday from Chicago. Hello.
Good morning.
What is Mr. Bernanke's next move?
Well, I think his next move will be to expand the balance sheet and further stimulate, but it'll be highly contingent on things like tomorrow's employment report, which I think will be another disappointing number. We've seen a lot of disappointing data out there, and this is a chairman that's made clear he will do everything he can in his power to avert a double-dip recession.
Well, you mentioned expanding what the Fed is doing. It's been a matter of internal debate. You know Ben Bernanke. You were at his symposium in Jackson Hole last week. How's he holding up?
You know, I think this is a very difficult time. We're in uncharted waters, economic waters. There's no precedent for what we're doing. And in that kind of environment, smart people disagree. The disagreements within the Federal Reserve about what to do next go deep. And there's a very badly divided Fed. And he's going to have to corral what are not just cats, it looks like lions now, to get the next move he wants to make out of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, there's been, we just have a few seconds here, but there's been a little, would you say, disloyalty around him?
I think that there was a lot of disloyalty around him, and I think that, you know, although smart people disagree, there's ways to do it in respectful ways, and there's ways to do it in disrespectful ways, and I think Ben Bernanke's had a rough couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Federal regulators are still looking into the causes of the so-called flash crash back in May. Remember, the stock market plunged momentarily?
Oh, yeah.
Dow was down like 1,000 points and then just
a crazy
bounced
day.
Back up. Well, we're trying to figure out what made it so crazy, and today we learned the Securities and Exchange Commission has some new leads in the case. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson joins us now from our New York Bureau. Morning.
Morning, Bill.
What is the SEC's latest suspect?
Well, according to a story in the Wall Street Journal this morning, regulators are looking into a practice called quote stuffing, which is basically when high-speed traders place a whole bunch of orders one second and then cancel them all the next, maybe to psych out competitors. The other practice is called sub-penny pricing, and with that, traders are placing big orders for stocks at a slightly lower price than where the stock is trading just to try and get a tiny discount.
I liked the name Flash Crash, and now I'm enjoying quote stuffing and sub-penny pricing.
Good.
But Jeremy, why would all of this have caused the crash?
Because when you compare what happened in the flash crash with other mini flash crashes in certain stocks that have happened on other days, some see a pattern that high-frequency traders, perhaps intentionally, clog up the system with a ton of orders to slow down the information everyone else is getting and give themselves an advantage. And in doing so, stock prices can get screwed up, which is what happened on May 6th. Now, I spoke with Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics, and he says regulators should take a close look at this.
It needs to be looked at. But there's nothing wrong with somebody putting a lot of orders in if they want to do it. Because remember, they're creating risk for themselves. They could blow themselves up if they make a mistake.
But Bill, he says all this kind of behavior turns ordinary investors off because they don't feel like the market is safe and they don't feel like they're competing on a level playing field.
Right. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York City. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
A new report out today takes a look at how small businesses are affected by the new health care reform law. The law includes a tax credit to help small businesses afford health insurance. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
The tax credit applies to businesses with 25 or fewer workers and an average wage below $50,000. The report was released by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that researches health care policy. The fund's vice president, Sarah Collins, says the credit will be worth a lot.
This will save small businesses about $40 billion over the next 10 years. So this is a significant economic stimulus.
Still, some small business groups have been less than enthusiastic. They point out that the tax credit is temporary, and they say the new health care law doesn't do enough to bring down the cost of premiums. Molly Brogan is a spokeswoman for the National Small Business Association.
A tax credit on a health insurance plan that's extremely expensive isn't going to do a whole lot of good.
But some research points to lower costs. The Congressional Budget Office says premiums for small businesses could fall as much as 4%. The CBO says the health care reform law simplifies the process of buying insurance, so administrative costs could go down. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today, Burger King agreed to be acquired by the investment firm 3G Capital for a little bit more than $3.5 billion. The fast food giant, which has thousands of stores around the world, has been a public company since 2006. Steve West is a fast food industry analyst and vice president of the equity research firm Stifel Nicolaus. He's with us live from St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
I'm doing well. So why was Burger King so pumped about going private in the first place?
You know, I think you have to take a look at who owned Burger King, really. Their biggest shareholders were another private equity firm, and these are the guys that bought Burger King from Diageo in 2002 and then took them public in 2006.
Was another investment firm, right?
What's that?
Diageo was another investment firm, right?
Diageo was a publicly traded, basically a big liquor company
out of
London.
Okay.
And so when we look at that, the private equity firm that currently owns almost a little over 30% of the shares in Burger King have been looking to divest all those shares since 2006, and then when the market collapsed, they weren't able to do that. This allows them to divest all the shares in one big pop and then get out of that investment and move on to something different.
Burger King's been struggling lately, right? I mean, they tried to market themselves differently than McDonald's and the like, maybe targeting a younger audience?
Yeah, so I think as we look at the struggles of Burger King, it's not just a Burger King struggle. It's been a restaurant industry-wide struggle because of the recession we've been going through. And really, you look at McDonald's, Chipotle, and Panera, probably the only three restaurants that have really bucked the trends and done very well throughout this recession. And you're right, Burger King has kind of marketed more towards a much edgier type of marketing campaign, focused more on that 18 to 30-year-old single males, whereas McDonald's is much more broad-based, appealing to soccer moms, to old people, younger people, kids, or what have you.
Are we seeing any changes with Burger King with this deal, do you think?
You know, I think what you'll be able to see is, coming out of the public eye, they will be able to leverage up the balance sheet a little bit more than what they have now. This will allow them access to more capital, and then they can turn that around and reinvest back in the brand with remodeling, upgrading their technology and things like that, which is something that McDonald's has been doing all along, and it's really a big competitive disadvantage for Burger King not to be able to do that.
Steve West, Vice President of the equity research firm Stifel Nicolaus, thanks for your time.
All right, take care.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 2nd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States. The drilling operation to rescue 33 miners trapped underground in Chile has been suspended, or was suspended temporarily after a fault was detected in the rock, but now drilling has restarted. And we also learned the owner of that mine is in trouble and close to going bankrupt. The BBC's Gideon Long is with us from Copiapó, Chile, near where the miners are trapped. Good morning.
Hello there.
What happens to these miners and the rescue if the company goes bankrupt?
Well, the immediate implications of a bankruptcy would be on the wages of the miners, not so much on those miners who are trapped underground because their salaries will be covered by insurance, but by the 300 or so miners who also work at this mine who have not been able to go to work since the rock collapse of August the 5th. For the last month now, they've been turning up at the mine each day, they've been clocking on, and they say that the company has paid them for the month of August. However, there are rumours that the company is running out of money and that it won't be able to pay them going forward. So you have 300 miners here who are usually employed by this mine. They've been out of work effectively for the last month, and they will be out of work for at least 3 or 4 months longer while the rescue operation continues. They're concerned that their salaries will not be met. The company has said that it's talking to creditors to try and resolve its financial difficulties.
And Gideon, speaking of the rescue, what improvements have been made to the men's situation?
Well, their situation has improved dramatically, really, since they were discovered alive 10 days ago now. Food and water is being piped down to them through this borehole, through 700 meters of solid rock. They had their first hot meal yesterday. We're told it was rice, meatballs and chicken. So their strength is building. They've been able to wash. We saw video images of them yesterday, which showed that many of them had been able to shave off these heavy beards that they accumulated over 3 weeks down in the mine. They seem in good spirits. Psychologists are working with them from above ground to make sure they remain in good spirits over the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah,
so their situation is improving
there, Gideon.
Day in
Thank
day.
You. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. Gideon Long from the BBC down in Chile. China has the world's largest cell phone market. And starting this week, if someone buys one, they're going to have to hand over their personal information to the government. As Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the new law is getting mixed reviews.
There are 814 million cell phone subscribers in China, and up to now, most of them bought prepaid SIM cards. It was as quick and easy as buying a bowl of noodles. Now the government is making China's mobile operators register all their users. Here in Shanghai, where everyone from school kids to old men seemed to be texting each other, the reaction was mixed. A woman who would only give her surname Tong wasn't thrilled. I'm just going to wait until the last minute to register my phone, she said. She didn't want to explain why, but the anonymity the Chinese have enjoyed up to now has given a lot of freedom, including the freedom to text politically sensitive jokes and to photograph public demonstrations without fear of punishment. Not anymore. But businessman Mao Shuiping isn't worried. Mao says the new law is a good idea. He says he lost his phone once, and because it was registered, he got it back. The government says it's implementing the new policy to help cut down on cell phone fraud and spam. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Last year's tax on British bankers' bonuses failed. The UK's former finance minister, Alistair Darling, says as much, and he's the one that came up with that idea. At a financial conference, Darling said the bonus tax didn't curb excessive pay in the industry. From London, reporter Christopher Worth says it could signal international efforts to trim bonus pay or hitting a roadblock.
The UK's one-time 50% tax was intended to curb the kind of big payouts many say led to the risky behavior that caused the financial crisis. Jan Randolph watches the banking industry for IHS Global Insight.
It seems that, you know, if you want to get to the root of the problem, you're going to have to do much more than just provide an annual tax. And all it's done is provide a little bit more revenue for the government. It hasn't fundamentally changed incentives and behavior.
The British government raked in around $3 billion from the tax this year. But with continued public anger over bank bonuses, the former UK Treasury chief says other, more severe measures could be in store if banks don't change their bonus culture. For now, that doesn't seem to be happening. Credit Suisse gave out a round of surprise bonuses in London this week, and there's speculation that investment banks in the US may give out bonuses a month earlier this year to avoid possible taxes being discussed in Congress. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 2nd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, just go to the numbers at marketplace.org. There is a trend in urban living known as the community garden. More and more cities have these shared neighborhood gardens, which means they're also dealing with veggie theft.
Oh.
Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports on what it takes to make sure people reap the fruits of their labor.
I'm standing here in the community garden of Jackson Park, located on Chicago's south side. There's no one around right now, and the garden itself is not that big, but it's wedged in between a major road and a golf course. And there's a sign up that says, "Do not steal our food. We work hard to grow our crops. If you'd like to grow your own food, we have plots available."
I've had things stolen. It's disappointing. It's frustrating. But I've still been able to reap the enjoyment of growing this plant.
Ben Helfand runs NeighborSpace, a land trust for community gardens. He says vegetable theft in an open space in a city of 3 million has been a problem since the gardens were created. Helfand says the best way to prevent stolen veggies is to simply be inviting with the space.
People are less likely to steal from sites that they know are well-tended and loved.
Helfand says he knows of one garden that purposely grows extra vegetables near the sidewalk for anyone to take as they please. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
Well, maybe you're not buying as many organic veggies at the grocery store as you once did, or you're buying off brands. Yet, are you still splurging on your pet's food? A common practice these days, an understandable one. Marketplace's Adrian Hill joins us now to consider the financial and environmental costs of your beloved animal. Hello, Adrian.
Good morning.
So let's start with what it costs to keep a dog.
It's not cheap to keep a dog, as dog owners out there probably already know, but let's assume that public radio listeners are into rescue dogs. According to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, depending on the size of your dog, you might spend about $1,300 in that first year for the dog. Food, grooming, all those things, vet costs. And again, that's if you're planning to adopt a dog. If you buy new, you're going to pay more.
Wow. Now, let's continue the never-ending argument over cats versus dogs. I'm going to guess
dogs.
a cat would be cheaper, yes?
Cats are cheaper. Cats run about $1,000 the first year you have it. But again, not cheap overall.
Okay, now what about your pet's environmental footprint or paw print?
I was in touch with a woman named Brenda Vale who wrote a book called Time to Eat the Dog, The Real Guide to Sustainable Living, to find out what the least environmentally and most environmentally friendly pets are. It turns out at the top of the bad for the environment list is also the most expensive pet, and that's the big dog. My sister has a mastiff mix. She's fostering right now, so she probably doesn't want to hear this.
No, she's on the list, huh? So what is the best pet for the environment?
Any guesses?
I'm thinking something ceramic that eats very little.
Eats nothing at all.
I don't know, a little gerbil?
It's actually a goldfish.
Goldfish. Okay.
Humble goldfish. As Brenda Vale put it, it's vegetarian, it is cold-blooded, and it's small.
So maybe your sister consider a fish?
she's probably not going to give up her dogs. My sister loves the cuddliness and playfulness of the dogs, but if you're out there thinking about a pet, a goldfish is good for the environment and cheaper. A fish is only about $200 a year.
Good to know. Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thank you.
Thanks.
A couple of stories as we end the program today. The long plastic African horn. Remember, Bill, the vuvuzela?
Oh, I can never forget.
Could you forget that? Well, it took center stage, of course, at the World Cup soccer tournament in South Africa earlier this summer. Who can forget those revelers at every game blowing with glee their horns for their teams?
Yeah, I tell you who would like to forget,
who?
Steve. The body that oversees European soccer has put the kibosh on that fantastic instrument, saying it wants to protect the game's, quote, culture and tradition.
Well, you know, translated, you know what that means? Yeah, keep that piercing noise away from our stadiums.
Yes, I think so. And finally, one of the biggest YouTube videos of all time is now a commercial. 13 million people have watched that Yosemite hiker discover a
double rainbow all the way across the sky.
That hiker, Paul Vasquez, remember he had a little trouble fitting the entire double rainbow into the video screen?
Yes, he did.
Which leads us to his new ad for Microsoft video editing software.
With Windows Live Photo Gallery, you can use Photo Stitch to combine adjacent photos and capture that double rainbow the way it should be captured. Full on, all the way across the sky.
What does it mean?
Bill, is it a sad commercialization of his innocent joy?
Or is it just a brilliant marketing move?
Or
maybe both.
Both.
Yeah, actually. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.